Brother Keith and dear class members, we certainly have had another one of those remarkable weeks that seem to be the features of the last perhaps 4 years. I suppose 1989 was when we saw just such a continuous cycle of events, remarkable, large events, that we now have almost got used to that kind of a year, haven't we? Last year was somewhat indecisive. It was a year of lesser events in which there seemed to be a lot of preparation for things. But it seems that we've just entered into this last 4 years, a period where even large things and very significant don't seem to register very greatly. I think it was Brother David on a Sunday morning who quoted, didn't he, some of the detail of Robert Roberts, and didn't seem to be a matter of very great consequence at all compared to the circumstances that we see happening in our world. And yet there he was, taking great observation of those things. Not so long ago, just late last year, Mr. Shevardnadze who used to be, of course, the foreign minister of Russia. He was interviewed by Time magazine, and some of the comments he made were really very interesting. The first question was, do Boris Yeltsin and democracy have a better chance to succeed in Russia than Mikhail Gorbachev did? Yeltsin, he said, is in great difficulty. He doesn't speak much about it, but I can see, as he describes it, that the dark forces are becoming stronger. It is a very dangerous moment. Now, that's what he said back in about December of last year. What are these dark forces? They are even more reactionary than the former communists, the most extreme reactionaries of the communists and the chauvinists. I would put them somewhere approaching fascism. Don't write that man off. He was the one that said that Gorbachev should beware of a coup, wasn't he, back a year or so before that. And he said that well before anyone else was saying it. And he turned out, of course, to be absolutely right. And so I thought that was a comment worth noting at the time. Now, this is our concept, isn't it? We've got that today in Europe. This is really, really very good description. See these there columns with a star on the top, see? The star columns. And every one of those columns represents those that are already in the European community. So there's 12 of them. And all these down here, this was in colour, are in red. All these figures here were in red. These were in blue. So you're either in the fortress, the economic fortress, or you're wandering out here like sheep in red. That is, you had come from communist countries and didn't know quite who you belonged to. And so there was a question, will Europe let down the drawbridge and let you in or not? Very clever, isn't it? That whole concept is very clever. And so the article went on then to say that the logic of all the factors in Europe, the logic of it surely must be, for greater security, that a larger fortress, a larger community is developed, in which all those little fellows that we saw hanging around wondering if they'd get in, they're all in together, here's a lot of extra stars, Europe is together, and here we've got blue and red all in the same party together. And you know, that I couldn't help feel was dramatically interesting to us, because really that is our concept. Since the days of Dr. Thomas, that has been our concept, that Europe would find its way together. In simple terms, my dear and sisters, it's Daniel chapter 2, isn't it? In simple terms, it's Daniel chapter 2, in which there is an unexpected confederacy. A confederacy that would not be a natural confederacy. They come from different lines, but in the end, they are found in there together. Now, in the same article, there was some very interesting quotations.
Excuse me, Brian, can you just stand a bit to the left?
No.
The light is blocking.
Perhaps if I read it like everyone else is. In the view of Jiří Dienstbier, Czechoslovakia's first post-Cold War foreign minister, the real goal should be overcoming the mindset that still divides the continent in two. You know what Daniel 2 says, doesn't it? Clay and iron. The iron that's come from the Roman European world, and the clay, surely, that which has come from Slavic, more rustic, less developed, less sophisticated Eastern countries. The danger today is not an arms race, he pointed out, but the gap between haves and have-nots. Winston Churchill, he recalled, was branded an alarmist by many Britons in the late 1930s for warning about a different sort of peril. It said the philosophically minded Dienstbier, "I have a feeling sometimes that time is running out so quickly that we may be late as before." Sorry, Jim. "We may be late as before." That is, when Winston Churchill warned that it was a time to do something about socialism and communism in Russia so that there will be peace in Europe. That's a terribly interesting quotation, isn't it? There are haves and have-nots. There are those in the fortress in blue, and there are those outside in red. And so the whole tenor of this article is that Europe's security, her real future, rests in coming together and doing something to pull everybody up fairly well so that they can walk along in the same line. Now, isn't that interesting? Exactly what we've always believed would be the case. Can we have a European unity without Russia? The handicapping of commerce among Central Europe's nations is not to say anything about Russia, which is totally out of the game. And that, I think, would be a terrible mistake for Europe. History over 10 centuries has shown that when Russia is out of Europe, Russia will try to find a way into Europe. And don't let any of us forget that she's still the greatest greatest military power in the continent. And so it seems to me, my dear brothers and sisters, that we ought to persist with our concept that Europe will come together and that Europe will see, Western Europe, that it has a need to have good terms and relationship with Russia because of political expediency. A single currency requires administration by a central bank. Now, this is the trend, of course, in Western Europe, which necessarily would usurp the member states' command of monetary policy, and in so doing diminish their sovereignty and room for economic manoeuvre. An embryonic form of political unity would in turn enable the European community to begin formulating common policies on security and defence, especially now that the nuclear balance of terror nightmare has ebbed. That is to say, if you're going to have one unit of currency, which is what they're talking about, then you've got to really have the same monetary policies, and that inevitably is going to affect the security and defence, common policies on security and defence. Common policies on security and defence. Do you think then that that group of nations are going to be able to develop a policy for its own security and unity that will leave out Russia? That is politically naive, isn't it? There must be some way in which they make a relationship with Russia. And so whatever happens in the present struggle, just another quotation here, same lines, besides moving forcefully to avert further havoc in its own money markets, Atalay argued the EC should launch an urgent effort to bring the former Soviet bloc more securely into the communist community's orbit. That was a bad mistake. Into the community's orbit. By the year 2000, he warned, it will be too late. We need a shortcut now, in the next 6 months. You know, this was December the 28th. If that had have occurred then, the present predicament would not have arisen. So, you know, it's a very pertinent comment. If not, the West will be seen as the main reason for the failure of democracy in the East. The lamps are going out in one part of Europe indeed, and the result is a house in some ways more treacherously divided than it was during the Cold War. Isn't that a remarkable quotation? So all of those men are saying that what we expect is really what should happen, politically speaking, in the present situation. But living in Russia, this is what dictatorship, as Nazi also said, and this is much more recently. Dictatorship, he said, is coming. No one knows what the dictatorship will be like, what kind of dictator will come to power, and what order will be established. And you know, that's as true when he said that just recently as it is tonight. Did you read the current reports in the papers? It's very difficult, isn't it, to say what is going to happen. Just in rough terms, my dear brothers and sisters, this is what's happened. There is an executive in Russia, headed up by a president. That's American style. They elect a president, and he has an administration, and they get on with seeing that things get done. But there's also a parliament, which in Russia is called a Congress. And there's a Supreme Soviet, which is dependent upon Congress. Congress has had a meeting. And what they've done during that meeting is cut down the powers of the president. They've been gradually making things difficult for him because he can see, like that previous transparency said, there's a need to move with urgency. You can't stand dilly-dallying around between communism and capitalism for too long before you're nothing. You've got complete disillusion. You don't belong to either camp. And so Boris Yeltsin has been saying to the nation, we've got to move forward more quickly. But the brakes are on because all of this Congress is made up of what used to be communists. You see, you think of it like this. Although there was a revolt against communism, who are you going to elect to the parliament, to the Congress? Who was well known in public matters? Who was well known in party matters, in administration, in public affairs? Well, they were all communists, weren't they? There wasn't anyone else that was well known. So all right, they put on a change of garment, they went for election and said, we're Yeltsin men, we're in favour of change, and so they got elected. But they really weren't, were they? They were brought up as communists. In their heart of hearts, that's no doubt what they were. So when things got tough and the medicine was dished out, the economic medicine, and you know, the potato prices rose and the butter prices rose, more butter, more potatoes, but it costs more. And things started to really squeeze the average Russian. He said, I don't like this. I like it when it was cheap and easy. Never mind that his country was going down and down and down. He personally found it a little easier. You see, now he's had to get off his haunches and do something about his own survival. It's not just dished out. And that's, of course, what the country has to do. But it's medicine. And no more do they like it in Russia than they like it here in Australia. Like we didn't hear a word about what people ought to be doing in Australia to help Australia in the election. It was all about dish outs, wasn't it? That the supposed new government was going to hand out. Well, they're the same in Russia. But worse, because that's how they've been brought up, you see, to think that everything's dished out for you. Now, when therefore the effects of the medicine are being felt by the people, they're saying, I don't know whether I really like this. And so it's easy then for the Congress to turn coat on the president and say, we're not in favour of your reforms, because right in the middle of that Congress were men whose hearts were so into communism since they were little boys. And the majority of them, in their heart, oh, no doubt, are exactly that. Now they're showing their true colours. And so you've got a house divided. You've got Mr. Yeltsin going this way, and you've got the Congress saying we're going that way. And for the last 6 months, he hasn't been able to do anything much in the way of reforms, and now they've come together and they've curbed his powers, taken some of his options away from him, until eventually he walked out of that Congress and he said, I will have to do it some other way. And when his deputy was approached, they said to the leader of the Congress, make no mistake, Mr. Yeltsin is not coming back. Now that only left a couple of options. What does a president do? He is the president, elected president of the country. What does he do? He can't get anything through Parliament because that group of men are inhibiting his cause. Now he did, I think, the only thing he can do. He said, all right, I've got to make a decision. And he said, it'll go to the people. So he said on April the 25th there'll be a referendum and the country will have to decide whether it's going to be the executive, that is the president and his administration, or whether it's going to be the Congress that sets this country going. Now, that represents old ways, this represents reform and capitalism. Now the question is, my dear brothers and sisters, which of those is going to be favoured by the country? But in the middle of that,
comes today, the announcement that he is likely to be impeached. Now, what does it mean, impeached? It's got nothing to do with fruit, by the way. It's only in Australia we get that in politics. But what it means is that if the president does something which is really seriously against the laws of the country, then Congress can say, we will remove you, because who else can do it? Who can take a president away? Well, only Congress, the supreme governing parliament of Russia. And they say that in taking all powers to himself, which he has taken from the day he said it, until April the 25th, he's running that country as a dictator, really, by decree. When I was in the Philippines, you'd see little placards. Do you remember? I remember telling the story. You'd see them on the lawn. Keep the lawns tidy. Presidential decree number 6,332. So everybody had to keep the lawns clean. The president made a decree. You don't see that around Australia, do you? Because we're not ruled by presidential decree. That's how he's going to rule it. He'll say, thus and thus, whatever he says, will go in that country. Well, that's a big gamble, isn't it? Will the police follow you? Will the army follow you? Aren't most of the army conservative, that is to say, from communist days? Yes, they are. No doubt about it. It was a terrific gamble, but you know, it was upon a military tank that he stood up originally, wasn't it? And addressed the people. And when he did that, the army split itself and they would not go against him. Some were prepared to go with that anti-reform push that was made by those ex-communists about 18 months ago, but the rest of them would not. And the people's tide of feeling was all for him, for reform. But you see, now it's swung around. They're not so much that way. They've got hungry tummies, or they've got difficulties at home, or whatever, paying more for their vodka. All those things, real big issues. But they are nevertheless having their effects. And now he said he's going to go to the people, whilst before he had a tremendous endorsement. The question is really a big one today. Will he get the endorsement? Now, what do you think? No. I said, what do you think? I did hear another comment, Kev, that it would take 12 months to impeach him. Did you hear that comment? Which sort of is a long time after April the 25th, isn't it? The Congress wouldn't exist then anyway after the 25th, if he gets the plebiscite that he wants. Well, he's told them to remain neutral in the whole matter. And if you read the latest Time magazine, it really is quite... You can't read that magazine without tingling with excitement. It's... The article is just breathing the sense of this nation, where will it go? The thing's right up in the air at the moment. Isn't that exciting for us? I'll tell you what I think, my dear brothers and sisters. Whether Yeltsin holds it or whether the others don't, I believe, according to what we've seen, and this is what we ought to keep our eyes on, there's got to be a relationship, a working relationship with Western Europe, doesn't it? Now, even if the new crowd go in, which are really the old boys in another dress, even if they displace Yeltsin, they're going to have to moderate their situation so that they can at least work in with a capitalist Western Europe. There is, in my view, no way of going completely back to communism. Communism is a no-through road. You can only go down and further down. I cannot see any future in communism at all. China speaks of communism that plays capitalism. They've got the fastest growing economy in the world, but it's not based on communist principles, make no mistake. It's based absolutely on the old Chinese art of commerce and business. And that's what Russia never learned. They remained in economics, communists, whilst they were changing in politics towards capitalism. But the Chinese were a bit smarter. They retained a political show of communism, but the economy, which was what really counts, was truly capitalistic. And so they're marching ahead. And I believe that that's possibly what might happen. On the other hand, Boris Yeltsin might hold sway. He may have to take it further. Some might say, well, why ever was it then, if Boris Yeltsin holds the sway, that Gorbachev was replaced? Why have we had these upsets? Why wasn't it sort of a peaceful merger into something like what Mr. Yeltsin's going to bring? Well, I don't know, but it does make you wonder, doesn't it, that in all of the instability, it does allow for a strong personality to come through. And I think that could well be the reason things are like they are at the moment. It's a very... Sorry.
In the Australian yesterday, one of the writers was suggesting that it may deteriorate into martial law. And they were rather fearful that should that happen, the old nuclear threat will be revived, because there would be the military generals saying they will do whatever they have to do to maintain.
Yes, that's right. And note also this, brethren and sisters, that the Congress is really quite anti-West. Make no mistake about that. They are anti-West. They do not like America. They do not like Russia doing what the West wants them to do. They are really strongly anti-West. Now, that's an interesting ingredient. That's not necessarily against Western Europe, because Western Europe's got its own particular dose of anti-American flavour too, hasn't it? Anti-British, anti-American flavour. And I don't see it at all difficult for them to just modify to a certain degree, but perhaps to have that quality of setting the pace, of leadership, of strength, of a measure of independence from Europe. You know, in a collective group of nations, if she's going to make the final move and really set the world alight by descending into the Middle East, she has to have the quality, doesn't she, of decision-making, of leadership, of a measure of independence to drag those others with her. Now, I don't see that as inconsistent with the old guard coming back in. I just see their communism as inconsistent. And I don't think they can live with communism. I was interested to notice in reading the Time magazine that the view of the American administration is, we have shown our colours for Yeltsin, because if the other crowd get in, there's nothing they can do anyway. Whoever gets in has got to go along with the West. They need help at this time. And that's a lot of truth in that. Any further comment? It's a remarkable time, my dear and sisters, to be alive, isn't it? Is not this he of whom I spoke in ancient times, said Ezekiel? And to think that we are the generation that are living in the time when that great power is being formed is a very ominous matter indeed. The 15th and the 16th chapters of Isaiah are both chapters that have to do with the country of Moab. Tonight we intend to give a history of Moab, because it's running right through these chapters, and without which we really would fail to see the depth and intent of much of the two chapters. And we hope, my dear brothers and sisters, to cover that history round about 9 o'clock, and then to have a look at chapter 15 in the subsequent 15 or 20 minutes. Now, of the origins of Moab, we read in Genesis 19. Intriguing history, isn't it? A really intriguing history. Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. And in Genesis chapter 19 and verse 30, Lot went up out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountain, and his two daughters with him. Now Zoar was the place of his refuge. Why did not he stay there? It says, for he feared to dwell in Zoar, and he dwelt in a cave, he and his two daughters. And if ever there's a tragic cut of a scene, it must be that. Here's this nephew of Abraham, now dwelling in a cave with his two daughters, whose husbands or husbands-to-be have been taken by the destruction of the city. But you see, if he dwelt in Zoar, he had a problem, because Zoar was confederate with Sodom. If you have a look at chapter 14, did you notice that Zoar was one of the cities that was confederate with Sodom and Gomorrah? 14 verse 2, that these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemeba, king of Zeboam, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. Alright? So the men of Zoar are not going to think very highly of a man, the only man and his two daughters, who escaped from a city, one of their sister cities, that was destroyed. And he comes and dwells there. Obviously he would be in fear of his life, wouldn't he? When are these people that were friendly with Sodom and are in great grief because of the terrific deluge, when are they going to take it out on me because I got out of the place safely? And because he got out, no doubt they may have thought that he was something to do with why the city was destroyed, considering the minds of the people of that era. So he left Zoar and dwelt in a cave. Do you know who that is? That's Abraham's nephew. Isn't that a tragic comment? But look at the comment in verse 31. What do you know about this family? And the firstborn said unto the younger, our father is old, and there is not a man in the earth to come in unto us after the manner of all the earth. Did you notice the reference to manner of all the earth and not a man in the earth? These two girls are just girls of the world, aren't they? That's all you could really say about their mind. The concept which they had of overcoming their present problem had no element of divine revelation or divine providence in it, did it? We just have to do what the people of the world do. And we have to do it by whatever means we can. Was there not an alternative to verse 31? Didn't Abraham still exist? Hadn't they heard of their father's uncle, Abraham, and of his 318 trained servants, all of whom had families? I mean, surely there was opportunities of marriage if they had gone to that company, that faithful company. But wouldn't Lot have told them that? Try and look into that home, my dear brothers, and understand that. You know how Peter says, and Jude, that Lot was a righteous man. That righteous man vexed his righteous soul with the filthy conversation of the wicked. But what was it then that prevented Lot from telling his girls where they should go and whom they could marry? Well, there comes a time, my dear brothers and sisters, in the latter days, illustrated in a way that makes your heart beat with anxiety, that from time to time we see exactly that, don't we? Where children carried along by the world and parents allowing them into circumstances which are dangerous, which affect their mind and their thinking, eventually cannot say to those children in terms they understand what they should do, because the children have got no register. They cannot pick it up. The mind is so sunk in all that Sodom was doing. They had boyfriends and outside the truth, engaged to them. What do you think they spoke about to the boys of Sodom and Gomorrah? Exactly what you get on our radio today. Exactly the same stuff. You see, the minds were debauched. They did not have those old connections. They had no sense of being part of the family of faith. This is a tragic account. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him that we may preserve seed of our father. Said these two, what, teenage girls? A bit more, perhaps? They are mature in everything that's evil, aren't they? They're just like the generation that's growing up. You couldn't tell them anything to make them blush. And my dear brothers and sisters, our kiddies are facing the same kind of world today. So they resorted to incest. incest, I might say, my dear brothers and sisters, that was not really the fault of Lot. You know, there's a proverb that is very applicable to those circumstances. It's a rather unpleasant proverb. Proverbs 23. They made him drunk. Would you like to think about making your father drunk? Look not thou upon the wine when it is red. Proverbs 23:31. When it giveth his colour in the cup, when it moveth itself aright, at the last it biteth like a serpent and stingeth like an adder. Thine eyes shall behold strange women, and thine heart shall utter perverse things. Yea, thou shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea, or as he that lieth upon the top of a mast. In other words, they will lose all control over what they are doing, and that's what happened to Lot. He didn't know what was happening. He got allured by the ever-increasing amount of wine into his mind, overcome by that, until he knew not what happened after that. In fact, the record emphasizes that, I'm sure, in defense of him. Verse 33, back in Genesis 19, they made their father drink wine that night. The firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he perceived not when she lay down, nor when she arose. That's just too terrible to think about, isn't it? Too terrible to think about. And it emphasizes that again at the end of verse 35. They made their father drink wine that night also, and the younger arose and lay with him, and he perceived not when she lay down, nor when she arose. They knew all about things, didn't they? You know, in our teaching of our children, my dear brothers and sisters, we have to just be so anxious and so open with them to make sure that our girls have got clean minds, that they are not affected by that kind of thinking. They will not let their minds grovel down into those kinds of levels, but they love spiritual thinking and attachment to spiritual families like Abraham's. This is the dreadful cost of building or buying a home in Sodom. And truly, this is a most terrible situation. There is now a great gulf fixed, isn't there? There's a great gulf, which is a Dead Sea, fixed between Abraham and Lot. Before, you know, he pitched towards Sodom, and he could often have gone back up to see Abraham. We don't know that he did, but indeed Lot was delivered back to Abraham. And Lot then seems to have gone right back into that situation until this time, when the judgment falls, he doesn't find his escape to the west and to Abraham and perhaps the chance of reunion, but the way it casts out, he comes to Zoar, which obviously must have been on the eastern side. There's a great gulf fixed, a gulf which is full of dead waters. And that's a tremendous exhortation, isn't it, to ourselves? Tremendous exhortation. You know, if our children have to go to school, my dear brothers and sisters, and our daughters at that, my view is quite frankly this: let them go to school, but don't let them get caught in all the things that this world wants to teach them. They do not have to be worldlings. They do not have to be trained in all the feminist, careerist ideas of the world that we have today. Keep our girls as girls whose preeminent thought is to be faithful husbands and wise and faithful parents. That's what we want our girls to think like. It was a desperately difficult thing to do it, however, in Sodom. And this righteous man, as Peter says, he nevertheless was not able to control that drift of his children. And now, with himself drunk with wine, they have played up in this way. And so they will be with child by their father. And verse 37 tells us of the outcome. The firstborn bare a son and called his name Moab, the same as the father of the Moabites unto this day. Waters of a father, that means. The water of a father is showing that in the very naming of that child, the means by which he came into life. And the younger, she also bare a son and called his name Ben-Ami, son of my people, the same as the father of the children of Ammon unto this day. So in the scriptures we often have these two peoples together, don't we?
Ammon that went more into the northern areas here, and Moab that was more in the southern areas adjacent to the Red Sea. We will talk a little bit more of that later on. So their country was east of the Dead Sea. It would seem, my dear brothers, it's just a general comment, that Ammon never had the kind of stability that Moab enjoyed. Moab seems to have gone into its area and basically stayed there. But Ammon, they seem to have travelled around. And sometimes they were more prominently alongside Israel, and other times they weren't. So there's a difference in these two people. But sometimes they also cooperated together. At times, Moab came to inhabit the whole of this area, right through here. Now, this is quite a lovely piece of country. Not when you get further out into the areas of Saudi Arabia, as we would call it today, it becomes really quite an absolute desert out there. But you'll see that there's quite a plateau that runs through here. There's some 40 or 50 miles, and it's good for about 20 or 30 miles. It's basically a red clay soil. It doesn't get the rains that the land of Israel gets. I can remember when we visited, in fact, Jordan. It was very interesting. In Israel, the crops were standing up like this on the maritime plain with beautiful heads, you know, some 30, some 60, some 100 fold. I'm sure they were beautiful crops. I've never seen anything quite so strong, magnificent. But over in Jordan, at the same time of the year, just a little bit before, I suppose, a week or two, there was nothing more than about 6 inches from the plain. So, you see, this area really gets what's left over as the rains sweep in from the Mediterranean, gets what's left over after Israel have first been given their serve of the rain. Isn't it interesting how the best was provided for Israel? However, the plain of Moab, this long length of country, is really good country. The people that inhabited it first were called the Emim, E-M-I-M. And they seem to have been displaced as Moab and Ammon went up that way. However, later on, when the Amorites that dwelt in Canaan were displaced by Israel coming in, they came into this area and they pushed at Moab. They pushed also Ammon out of the way, and the Moabites were displaced south to the River Arnon, which runs through here. You see that wadi, as they call it, running through, about midway along the length of the Dead Sea. And that from then after became the border, the northern border of the people of Moab. The northern border of the people of Moab was the River Arnon. Now, you know, in the scriptures, I think in Numbers 21, there's a little scripture which speaks about the brooks of Arnon. And I used to imagine, you know, it'd be something like, you saw in the Adelaide Park lands, we have these little creeks running through, and you go and pick 5 stones to beat the Goliath, that kind of thing. But no, it's entirely different. This wadi of Arnon is really a most remarkable division in that plain. You go along the plateau, and then you find it begins to descend. It would be a tremendous descent of perhaps 2,000 feet. It's a colossal descent. And the road just winds around like a Swiss road, going ever and ever downwards. And then up the other side it does the same thing. And I should think that between the one height and the other height, there must be something like 3 or 4 kilometres. It's just a most remarkable cut of the plateau of Moab. So anything south then became Moab, and anything north was where the Amorites came. The Amorites, for example, were headed up by a king whose name was Sihon, who was called King of Heshbon. Heshbon was the city that he reigned from, which is in about this area here. The people were the Amorites, and they came being displaced from the land of Canaan. Now, if you look in Numbers chapter 21, it'll give us a quick coverage of that. Verse 21. Numbers 21, verse 21. Israel sent messengers unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying,
See now, got the picture? Israel's coming up this way. They come around Edom, because Edom wouldn't let them go through, and they come around Moab. But they're not disposed to go around the Amorites, not at all. So they make request, you see. Let me pass through thy land. We will not turn into fields or into the vineyards. We will not drink of the waters of the well, but we will go along by the king's highway until we be past thy borders. And Sion would not suffer Israel to pass through his border. But he gathered his people together and went out against Israel into the wilderness, and he came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. And Israel smote him with the edge of the sword and possessed his land from Arnon unto Jabbok, even unto the children of Ammon, for the border of the children of Ammon was strong. And Israel took all these cities, and Israel dwelt in all the cities of the Amorites in Heshbon, and in all the villages thereof. For Heshbon was the city of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab, and taken all his land out of his hand, even unto Arnon, as I said. They displaced the Moabites right down to this point. Now they, in turn, have been displaced by a company of Israel coming up, and under the leadership of Moses, and they've defeated Heshbon and pushed them right up, it says, even unto Ammon, which means that Ammon therefore must have been inhabiting this area here. Ammon were a people that were given to sheep and pasture way of life, and so they seem to have been in this northeastern area here. And so now the Amorites have been pushed right out of the land, and that's going to allow Gad in this area, and Manasseh in this area, and Reuben in this area, to come in and occupy that territory as God had promised. Now in the 27th verse, it outlines a little bit more, 27 to 30, of what exactly happened when Sihon displaced Moab. Wherefore they that speak in Proverbs say, come into Heshbon, let the city of Sihon, who was king, be built and prepared. For there is a fire gone out of Heshbon, a flame from the city of Sihon. It hath consumed Ar of Moab, and the lords of the high places of Arnon. Woe to thee, Moab! Thou art undone, O people of Chemosh. Notice that phrase. Chemosh was the great god of the Moabites. So here they are called the people of Chemosh. He hath given his sons that escaped and his daughters into captivity unto Sihon, king of the Amorites. We have shot at them. Heshbon is perished even unto Dibon, and we have laid them waste even unto Nophah, and which reacheth unto Medeba. Thus Israel dwelt in the land of the Amorites. Now is that story clear? Emim, the Moabites and Ammonites, the Ammonites displaced by the Amorites, Israel come through and displace the Amorites right up to the north, and thus it becomes the habitation of Gad, half the tribe of Manasseh, and Reuben. So that's a very important little piece of history which is provided for us then. Well, what was Israel's attitude to Moab? If you have a look in the second chapter of Deuteronomy, that's key. Right. Second of Deuteronomy and verse 10 says, the Emims dwelt therein in times past, a people great and many and tall as the Anakims, which also were accounted giants as the Anakims, but the Moabites call them Emims. Sorry, that reference is just to show you who the original people were, right? That whole territory now has been taken over by the 2.5 tribes, as we've seen in Numbers 21. Now, what that did was leave Moab with a little piece of territory down here, which wasn't, in fact, pretty well enclosed. There it is there. Moab was an entity, something like that. And the rest of the country, right up to Jabbok, the river Jabbok, which is up here, was all now occupied, was going to be occupied by Israel. Now how do you think then Moab felt in that little enclosure? I say an enclosure because
On the western side, we have a very steep decline into the Dead Sea. On the northern side, we have the Brook of Arnon, this tremendous cleavage of the plateau. On the eastern side, we have hills at the rim of her area, and likewise also on the south.
So they were sort of in their own little enclave. How do you think they'd feel? Very isolated indeed. They've lost their brothers who were from Ammon, or their cousins perhaps from Ammon. They've been displaced. And now they're sitting there just, as it were, at Israel's mercy. And below them is the Edomites, whom they never got on too well with anyway. So Moab and Edom were sort of there together in their own areas, and they didn't get on well, but they were very vulnerable, weren't they? Being so much isolated from all the other peoples. Now in the 28th verse of Deuteronomy chapter 2, it says concerning the coming in of the children of Israel to this area, "Thou shalt sell me meat for money that I may eat, and give me water for money that I may drink. Only I will pass through on my feet," says Israel through Moses, "to Sihon of Heshbon." And then it says in verse 29, "As the children of Esau dwelt, which dwell in Seir, and the Moabites which dwell in Ar, did unto me, until I shall pass over Jordan into the land which Yahweh our God giveth us." So when Israel came to that area, all they asked for, apparently, was that they be given some victuals. They'd paid for them. They'd prepared to pay for them. And so to the border of Moab, because they never went through Moab, these victuals were brought to Israel and provided for the people. And so they went around Moab in that way. But it seems that Moab did all she could to frustrate that cause. In Deuteronomy chapter 23, there's a little bit of tension, I suppose, between this verse and the previous 29th verse in chapter 2, which obviously needs some extra information. But in reference to the Moabites, it says in verse 3, "An Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of Yahweh, even to their tenth generation, shall they not enter into the congregation of Yahweh forever, because they met you not with bread and with water in the way when you came forth out of Egypt, and because they hired against thee Balaam, the son of Beor, of Pethor, of Mesopotamia, to curse thee." So there's Moab's reaction to Israel. Now we have Israel's law written in concerning Moabites. Well then, add to that, my dear brothers and sisters, the account of Balaam. Numbers chapter 22. This is the next important event in the relationship of these people with God's people.
There is just in this area here. Sorry, Keith, I keep on doing that. You just pull me up next time. By the coattails. We have here a little area designated as the Plain of Moab. The mountains start about here. For example, here's Mount Nebo at 2,631 feet. And that's where Moses saw his last view of the land, isn't it? Well, slip down from those hills and we come to the Plain of Moab, which is between the River Jordan and between the hills. Now, Israel were just in that area, about to go into the Promised Land. And now you can perhaps perceive why Moab felt so desperate and why she went right out to the east to hire Balaam to come and do something which a prophet knew he really couldn't perform. That is to say, we will give you money if you bring curses upon Israel. And you can understand, they were desperate, really desperate. Because here they were left in this little enclave here at the mercy of Israel, surrounded on every side and prevented from getting to their natural friends, their natural supporters. So that puts an extra understanding into this situation. We know through those three chapters that Balaam, with his eyes absolutely green with dollars, he could not, however, go against what God did. And as Israel rested down those plains,
beyond the hills. He came from one vantage point to another as he went around, and out of his mouth came the most beautiful statements about Israel, and also about the cursing of Moab in place of Israel. That record is in Numbers 22 to 24 and is a very important feature in the story of Israel's relationship with Moab. If you have a look in Numbers 24 and verse 17, it says, "I shall see him but not now, I shall behold him but not nigh. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite the corners of Moab, and destroy all the children of Sheth." You can imagine that that comment was really enjoyed by the elders of Moab. "Out of Jacob," verse 19, "shall come he that shall have dominion, and shall destroy him that remaineth of Ar," A-R. And that was, of course, one of the two principal cities of the Moabites. Instead of the city, it should be a capital name, Ar, which was one of the great cities of the Moabites. So there were references within the songs of Balaam which particularly brought cursing upon Moab in the midst of Israel's blessings. You know, it's a very interesting consideration, my dear brothers and sisters. Have a look at Deuteronomy 34. You know, some great people were in Moab. Deuteronomy 34 and verse 6 of Moses, it says, "They buried him in a valley in the land of Moab, over against Beth Peor." You know how he fought against Peor? Beth Peor. "He died over against it, but no man knoweth of his sepulchre unto this day." What a wonderful thing, my dear, but this is a contemplate that somewhere here is the grave of Moses, the lawgiver, took them to the promised land. Well, he's buried in the plains of Moab there somewhere. Very interesting and thoughtful consideration. It was, of course, from just above that, as I said, on Mount Nebo, where he looked over the Jordan, north and south, and saw all the land before him. Well, the next significant event is found in Judges chapter 2. I'm sorry, Judges chapter 3. As you can imagine, since Benjamin occupied this area here, we would expect that it would be Benjamin that would be doing some battles with Moab across the River Jordan. And surely it was in Judges chapter 3, where we read verse 12, "The children of Israel did evil again in the sight of Yahweh, and Yahweh strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done evil in the sight of Yahweh. And he gathered unto him the children of Ammon and Amalek, and went and smote Israel, and possessed the city of palm trees," that's Jericho. "So the children of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. Now that's a mighty achievement, isn't it? We saw the circumstances of Moab. We've seen how great kings were removed. And yet now, this power has come up and is now occupying this area where Benjamin should have been. And they're serving the king of Moab 18 years. That's a quite remarkable reverse in fortunes. In the 1 Samuel chapter 14, I wonder if you've ever noticed this little reference. You know, Saul had many conquests. And so in the 47th verse of 1 Samuel 14 it says, "So Saul took the kingdom over Israel and fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, and against the children of Ammon, and against Edom, and against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. And whithersoever he turned himself, he vexed them." So there was a great battle against the Moabites by Saul. In fact, it seems to be one of the first of those that he had conquest over. And we've missed a really interesting part of the story of Moab. What is that? Ruth, that's right, Ruth the Moabitess. All through the story of Ruth, she is referred to as Ruth the Moabitess. Look quickly at Ruth chapter 2. I mean, she's no longer in Moab, but she's always the Moabitess. And Ruth the Moabitess, chapter 2 verse 2. 1 verse 22, Ruth the Moabitess. Verse 6, the Moabitish damsel. And so it goes on through that record. Isn't that an interesting thing? Chapter 2, verse 21, Ruth the Moabitess. So when you think of that, my dear brothers and sisters, and realise that Ruth becomes the great, great grandmother of David, then David has Lot's blood, as it were, within him, doesn't he? Isn't that an interesting connection? So, to sort of preserve that connection, because these people came from the very stock from which Abraham came. They had Terah as their common ancestor. These people came from that. And it's a most beautiful thing to think that finally, when a king arose who would be like a star in Jacob to bring about great victories in every direction, some of his heritage had come not only from Abraham but also from Lot, in that his great-great-great-grandmother was from the stock of Lot. Isn't that interesting thing? And so God prevents us from despising a people, because, as we said, Moses is there and some of David's heritage was there. However, in the 2 Samuel 8 verse 1, David went against Moab. It's mentioned in the list of his victories. 8 verse 2, I think I said verse 1, didn't I? And he smote Moab and measured them with a line, casting them down to the ground. Or the Revised Version and Revised Standard Version say, making them to lie down on the ground. Making them to lie down on the ground. Even with two lines measured he to put to death, and with one full line to keep alive. Two thirds of the city shall be cut off. It's the same concept, isn't it? Isn't that a terrible thing? And yet, when David was having trouble with Saul, and he wished to protect his father and mother, we read, in fact, that he sent them to the king of Moab in the 1 Samuel 22. Verse 3, David went thence to Mizpah of Moab, and he said unto the king of Moab, let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be God and be with you till I know what God will do for me. He spoke to the king of Moab like that. What God will do for me. Isn't that an amazing thing? And I suppose he felt like these, in fact, are part of my kinship. This is where Ruth came from, who was a wonderful person in my heritage. Now he takes his own mum and dad, he takes them there that they might be protected in the time of his exile. He brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the while that David was in the hold. Isn't that absolutely beautiful? But something has happened, hasn't it, that has vehemently stirred David's vengeance towards them. And so we read of that terrible massacre in the 2 Samuel 8 verse 2, where he measured two thirds for death, one third to live. And so he brought this terrible judgment upon them. So the Moabites became David's servants and brought gifts to him, it says. So something obviously happened between that and the former incident that made David feel so vehemently against them. Now, David's son, with the same heritage, perhaps he thought too that he had some kinship with Moab, because we read in the 1 Kings 11 and verse 1 that he took strange women, and the first women that are mentioned, apart from the daughter of Pharaoh, was the women of the Moabites. They were brought into what we might call the royal harem. Women of Moab. And my dear brothers and sisters, isn't that an amazing statement? Who was it who brought disgrace upon Israel in the wilderness through the advice of Balaam? It was the very women of Moab. They were the very ones, and Ammon, who brought that disgrace upon which God sent a plague. And thousands of them were destroyed. And Solomon now has brought those women into his domain. What a tragic concept it was to do that. I suppose he might have thought, well, Ruth came from Moab, but it was an entirely different person that he took out of Moab, wasn't it? And so we read in verse 7 of the consequence of that. Then did Solomon build a high place for Chemosh, for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, in the hill that is before Jerusalem. That is to say, the Mount of Olives, the hill that is on the east of Jerusalem. And for Molech, the abomination of the children of Ammon. Now both Chemosh and Molech, the gods of Moab and Ammon respectively, were fire gods. And both of them were served in similar ways. You know how we speak about them offering their children unto Molech. Now can you imagine, my dear friends, can you possibly conceive that on the Mount of Olives, and we know its glorious past and we know its even greater future, on the Mount of Olives, Solomon, David's son, set up a temple there for Chemosh. What an most incredible thing that was. What a filthy abomination, overlooking the city of Jerusalem. It reminds me, you know, of today. Because sitting up on that mount today is a Russian Orthodox church that's been there for a long time. You know that tall tower that's on the Mount of Olives that you see in the old photos? Well, that's a tower in a Russian monastery. It's been there for more than decades, for centuries of time, sitting over there overlooking the holy city. Well, this must have been just as evil and rotten to go to that place and see there. And you know, it was there for 400 years. It wasn't until the times of Josiah that it was dismantled. The reference, 2 Kings 23, verse 13. So the people of Chemosh had an unfortunate victory in that regard over Israel. Now, moving on quickly, in the 2 Kings chapter 1 and verse 1, what's the opening statement of the 2 Kings? It's intriguing, really quite intriguing. It's sort of all there by itself. 2 Kings 1 verse 1. Then Moab rebelled against Israel after the death of Ahab. And the rest of the chapter doesn't seem to go on about that. But there's a little statement. What does that tell us? It tells us that before that time, Moab was under tribute to the northern kingdom, because Ahab, of course, was a northern king. So Moab down here was under tribute to the northern kingdom. I suppose it was easier to get access through there than for Judah to come around. And in the days of Omri, he had exacted tremendous tribute from the king of Moab. Now that record is in the 2 Kings 3 verse 4, where we are introduced to a man called Mesha. Mesha, king of Moab. You might like just to pass those around. I won't stop, but we'll just keep concentrating because we really need every minute we've got. Here we're introduced to this Mesha, king of Moab, it says, who was a sheep master. So it was a pastoral area with great numbers of sheep. And rendered unto the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and 100,000 rams with the wool. That's a lot of flock. Well, looking at the times of superphosphate and regenerated pasture and all that type of thing, aren't we? We're looking at just plain open country, not a lot of it, not a big sweep. And yet they've been able to provide for the king of Israel 200,000 in number of their kind. And it came to pass when Ahab was dead that the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. So that's telling us that during Omri's reign, and during Ahab, who was the son of Omri, during his reign, in the reign of those two kings, this tribute was paid to the king of Israel by the king of Moab. Got the picture? And then she rebels. Moab rebels. Now the outcome of that is given in the rest of that chapter, all of which we really cannot relay. But it's the time when three kings join together. Jehoram, who was the king of the north, he said to Jehoshaphat, come with me. And so we had the strange picture of the two kings of Israel joined together. But they came down here, down this way, because Jehoshaphat said to Jehoram, by which way shall we go? In other words, we go this way, I suppose it's a natural way to think, or shall we go this way? And he said, no, we're going to come this way. So when they came through, they joined hands with the king of Edom. Not only was this a most unlikely alliance, and something God could not really be pleased with. But to pick up Edom as well and to make a confederacy of three kings was really quite a unique event. And so they came towards Moab, who came to the borders and looked out, you see. And God had sent Elisha with that company of three kings. Verse 13 of 2 Kings 3. Elisha said unto the king of Israel, "What have I to do with thee?" The king of Israel acted as the spokesman. "Get thee to the prophets of thy father, and to the prophets of thy mother." And the king of Israel said unto him, "Nay, for Yahweh hath called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab." So he retaliates against Elisha. Does the king of Israel, apostate as he was, son of Ahab? And Elisha said, "As Yahweh of hosts liveth, before whom I stand, surely were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat the king of Judah, I would not look toward thee nor see thee. But now bring me a minstrel." And it came to pass when the minstrel played that the hand of Yahweh came upon him. And he said, "Thus saith Yahweh, make this valley full of ditches. For thus saith Yahweh, ye shall not see wind, neither shall ye see rain." In other words, the wind that normally brings the clouds and deposits the rain. You won't see that yet. "That valley shall be filled with water, that ye may drink, both ye and your cattle and your beasts." And this is but a light thing in the sight of Yahweh. "He will deliver the Moabites also into your hand." Now what an amazing thing. You're way down in this sort of territory where, of course, things were very desperate for water. And all of a sudden, Elisha, in the company of the three kings, makes this prophecy. "And ye shall smite," verse 19, "every fenced city and every choice city, and shall fell every good tree, and stop all wells of water, and mar every good piece of land with stones. It came to pass in the morning, when the meat offering was offered, that behold, there came water by the way of Edom, and the country was filled with water." Now, how did that happen, my dear brothers and sisters? I don't know. It says that it came by way of Edom. Now, we know that whatever that valley was, it was close to Moab. So here's Moab, right? Here's Moab in that little enclave I spoke about. And looking down from the hills of Moab, you look towards Edom. It was bordered on the south by hills. So you look down over one of those valleys, and the water was coming from Edom. So it came and filled that valley. It was full of ditches. Man would be digging there with his face, and about all these ditches, watered their cattle, plenty. And they rested, you see, in their tent. And in the morning, the Moabites came up to see who was coming. I suppose they got news that somebody was coming. And they looked down into the valley, and as the sun shone into the pools of the water in the valley, they were all blood red. And so they concluded that the Israelites, two groups of Israelites, and the Edomites had disseminated among themselves, and they had slain each other, and so now all was left to the Moabites. That was their description. "This is blood," verse 23. "The kings are surely slain, and they have smitten one another. Now therefore Moab to the spoil." And so they fled to the camp of the Israelites, and the Israelites are just around the canvas, and as soon as they came near, they popped out, and away they had Moab in 2 seconds. And so Moab was greatly defeated by the Israelites by this way. But the defeat of Moab was very, very all-encompassing. They beat down the cities on every good piece of land, cast every man his stone and filled it. And they stopped all the wells of water and felled all the good trees. Only in Kir-Harosheth left they the stones thereof. Howbeit the slingers went about it and smote it. Now Kir-Harosheth was the capital, a great fortress city. And in verse 26, the extremity of this terrible invasion which they suffered at the hand of Israel took the king to this extremity. "When the king of Moab, in Kir-Harosheth, this great fortress, saw that the battle was too sore for him, he took with him 700 men that drew swords to break through even unto the king of Edom, but they could not." I suppose he thought, "I've got some chance with Edom, where else do I go?" But he couldn't break through the ranks of the three kings' confederacy. And do you know what he then did? He took his eldest son that should have reigned in his stead and offered him for a burnt offering upon the wall. And there was a great indignation against Israel, and they departed from him and returned to their own land. Now, in the extract that you've got, entitled "The Moabite Stone," you've got one of the most amazing pieces of archaeology that you'd ever find. It says, I won't read it out, but you can read that tonight and you'll find that extremely interesting indeed. Can we just quickly turn to Isaiah 15? The history's taken a little longer than what we wanted, but it certainly does help us greatly to understand the sense of the chapters. In Isaiah chapter 15, the burden of Moab is introduced by the woe upon two cities in particular, because in the night, Ar of Moab is laid waste and brought to silence. Because in the night, Ker of Moab is laid waste and brought to silence. Ar was a city that sat astride the river Arnon. Ar and Arnon, as you can see. Perhaps also called Aroa in other places. It was a principal city of Moab. Now, Ker of Moab is this place here, Ker Harosheth. Whilst the one was on the northern side of the country, Ker was right in the middle. And that was that great fortress in which Mesha offered on the wall the body of his son. They were the two great cities of Moab. And so both of them now are spoken of as being brought to silence and laid to waste. Now, next week I'm going to show you some slides of Ker of Moab, and you'll see what an amazing statement that is in verse 1, that such a natural fortress, I wonder if there was ever a greater natural fortress than Ker of Moab. It would make the city of Jerusalem look so insignificant, so remarkably defended was it. And then we read, as we follow the invasion, the promised invasion force is gone up to Bajith, which means the house, and to Dibon, the high places to weep. In other words, they've gone to the house of Chemosh to set before their gods their calamity and to seek his help. Moab shall howl over Nebo and over Medeba. Nebo we have seen in this area, and Medeba, which is about there. Medeba is an interesting city set right in the middle of a plain, a natural place for forces to come together. And we should provide some evidence of that next time. On all their heads shall be baldness, and every beard cut off. In their streets they shall gird themselves with sackcloth, on the tops of their houses, and in their streets everyone shall howl, weeping abundantly. This said to a people that were enjoying great prosperity at the time of Ahaz, king of Judah. And Heshbon shall cry, and Elealeh. Heshbon, once the capital of Sihon, remember, of the Amorites. Now, obviously, a possession of Moab that has crept up north again and taken all those surrounding areas since now Reuben has been taken and lost its dominion over that land. So the Moabite is increasing all through that northern area, right up to the top of the Dead Sea and beyond. Their voice shall be heard even unto Jahaz. Therefore the armed soldiers of Moab shall cry out. His life shall be grievous unto him. Now, just finally, this verse in verse 5. In the midst of all that, and it's a touching note to ourselves as well, it says, my heart, Isaiah says, shall cry out for Moab. It's a beautiful thought, isn't it? That's the prophet's expression. He was not untouched in this terrible judgment that was to be poured out upon Moab. His fugitives shall flee unto Zoar, and Heifer of 3 years old, for by the morning up of the mounting up of Luith, with weeping shall they go up, for in the way of Horohain they shall raise up a cry of destruction. So the prophet himself becomes involved in the calamity. And I suppose, my dear brethren and sisters, that we can also feel that. You know, there were some great people there. Moses is buried there. Lot, the father of that country, was a kindred of Abraham, our father. David's lineage came from Moab. And finally, when the prophet then Isaiah is told to speak of this terrible judgment which would come upon that place, he says, my heart cries for Moab. You know, when we talk about the Russians, I thought as a similar thing. You know, they're all people, aren't they? You look at the photos and there's a woman and she's probably got children and there's a husband. They're all people, aren't they? It is a terrible thing when people go astray and by judgment have to be brought back into the things of God. And whilst it is our role to sound out Nevertheless, all of our message should be, like Isaiah, tinged with a sense of but for the grace of God, go ourselves. It's a balancing feature, and it's lovely to see that there in the prophet Isaiah in that 15th chapter. Thank you.